no one in the academic world knows the least bit about that at all. They just buy into the official story. They don't do any real research. And that can be extrapolated into any of these events. They buy into what the court historians are selling. Thomas Jefferson once famously said, in his day, people who don't read the newspapers are better informed than those who do. And, you know, that was back, presumably, when the news wasn't quite as fake. That's what history is today in the schools, and it's so limited. And that's why I think most Americans today are historically illiterate.
I am proud to offer another great product, ProxyStem Stem Cell Pro. This amazing product supports 8 areas of stem cell health, including the AMPK gene, which in a UCLA study, researchers showed in an animal model that by increasing the amount of AMPK in the body, they can increase a healthy lifespan by approximately 30%. mTOR inhibition. The mTOR inhibition has extended mouse mean lifespan by 33%. Also, biogenesis. The additional PQQ triggers mitochondrial biogenesis, which increases the number of mitochondria in your cells. These are the powerhouses of your cells. The energy-hungry brain and heart is believed to benefit greatly from PQQ. ProxyStem ingredients also increases the amount of telomerase protein that cells make when they are in a state of telomerase activation. With all the healthy cell benefits, this formula is the most advanced formula we have seen on the market. Also, with RevGenetics' brand new formula, it comes in a lower price. This means you're getting the best price anywhere for this product. Click the link below to see studies and to buy yours today.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. I have Donald Jeffries coming back, and we're going to talk more about his book because he really dove into history. It's called Crimes and Cover-ups in American Politics, 1776 to 1963. And when he came back last time, we talked a lot about the Revolutionary War and also about Abraham Lincoln and things that people just didn't know about that time period. And this time we're going to talk about the two world wars and some of the things that happened after that, including the chemical spraying on Americans and the populations, what they were doing with that. We talk a lot about McCarthy and what he really was and just different things about this time. And then we relate it a little bit to what's going on now. I think it's very interesting because it's not how you're taught about history. And so he dives into things that people just aren't aware of. It's not what the common narrative is. And so what is the truth on some of these things? So we get into that. And then he talks about his next book that's coming up. It's called Bulliocracy is what it's called. And it's about bullying. And we talk about that for my patrons. So if you're a patron, you can get that. But it's about how the students today, it's a different world with all the social media. And I got to tell you, until you experience it and see it firsthand, you might not believe it, but they're growing up with social media, not like we did. And it's different. I mean, they are bullied on social media. They fight on social media. Nude pictures get sent around. It's a different world. And we talk about that. And it's pretty interesting. He did a lot of research on that and how it differs. So I recommend you go into that. And before we get into the interview, I want to talk about my new shop that I have. I have things that are going to be added on there, more that are going to be added next week. But I have RevGenetics. Their products now are 10% off through the end of the year. I think I'm going to maybe be able to keep a coupon with some good discounts with them going. But the coupon now is just good for November. And just keep going back there because I'll have new coupons all the time. And then Defy Time, they are now double the discount. It used to be 5, now it's 10%, which is a big discount for how expensive their product is. And it can be used with other offers. So you can get that 10% off introductory offer plus this additional 10% off, but you can use it every time that you order. So you want to make sure you do that. And then I have some new products coming very soon. I have some good stuff that you want to keep an eye out for. And you can go to that by going to my website at Sarah Westall Shop. And then also be sure to get on my newsletter because my channel's demonetized a lot. And for some reason, I am getting a little more out there as far as people subscribing again. It's still way below my averages used to be, but I was held steady flat for so long. And now I'm starting to go up again. I don't know what's going on. But people are telling me all the time they're not getting notifications. So if you sign up for my newsletter, just go to my website. You can sign up for it on the side, on the bottom. There's also a window that pops up. And sign up for my newsletter. You'll not only get notifications, but you'll also get articles. I'm always publishing new articles that I found. I don't just find it on Drudge or something. I look all over the place. Like this time I have an article from Russia, and I have it from different activist sites. I have it from things I trust, but they're good articles that give you an idea of how the world is changing. I don't always think some of these articles, they're just like, okay, it's just another thing that I saw a million times. If it's something I think is really meaningful and I want to get it out to you. And once in a while I see something that's just fun and I throw that in there. But most of the time it's something that I see that's really meaningful that I think is important for you to see. And then my patrons, of course, always get the notifications and they get access to ebooks. I think there's 9 free ebooks up there right now. And I also have research and exclusive interviews, including this one today with Donald Jeffries. So let's get into my interview now with Donald Jeffries. Donald, thank you so much for rejoining the program.
It's always a pleasure, Sarah.
Well, the last time you were on, we did not get the opportunity to finish what your amazing book covered, because it was about a look at history in a way that people, you just weren't taught it in school. I mean, bottom line. And you went back through and looked at a whole bunch of things in this book. Can you tell us where you got your material from? Where did you find all this truth about what really happened?
Well, there you look for all the sources you can find, and I try to go to mainstream sources whenever possible, because I know people still, even people in our world, still kind of trust them more. They think it's more credible if it comes from the New York Times, even though we know obviously that they've published so much disinformation over the years. But a lot of this you can get from mainstream sources. It's just overlooked, and I refer a lot in the book to the court historians, and these are the people, the gatekeepers of the past, who serve the same purpose as the so-called journalists do. I mean, the Rachel Maddows and people like that, Chris Cuomo's of the world, do now, distorting, and they're leaving things out now, and they're not telling you the truth about what's going on. The court historians do the same thing with the past. They leave information out, even though it's readily available. I can go on the internet and do most all my research, and I've read a lot of books in the past and kept notes of them, and so I have those sources there with me. I read a lot, and it's very, and in some cases in this book I was able to talk to some people, obviously not many people left that were connected to these events, but usually their descendants. I talked to the descendants of John Wilkes Booth and Meriwether Lewis, people like that. So you can try to get, you know, that kind of perspective from people, but and it's just looking at it, and I don't have a theory. I just put the information out there. I mean, for instance, writing about something like the atrocities committed by the Northern troops in the Civil War or by the Allied forces in World War II, they're out there. You can find them. I mean, Kurt Vonnegut, you know, became a great novelist mainly about his experiences at Dresden when he wrote Slaughterhouse-5. And he talked about all the awful things that happened. Those were the good guys, supposedly, that did that, killed 38,000 toddlers or whatever. I mean, this is the greatest generation. So it's, you know, these are easy to find. It's just most court historians ignore them or minimize them or downplay what I'm talking about.
Well, now, why are schools so bad? Why are we learning false information when it's out there? I mean, aren't they supposed to be, even universities, aren't they supposed to be beacons of education? Why are our universities and our regular, you know, high schools so bad at teaching history? What's your opinion on that?
Well, I think decades of activity researching the JFK assassination, I can tell you that almost no one in the academic world knows the least bit about that at all. They just buy into the official story. They don't do any real research. And that can be extrapolated into any of these events. They buy into what the court historians are selling. So the newest book by Stephen Ambrose or people like that, or the latest documentary by Ken Burns, that's their idea of history. I call it Mick history. It's fast food history. And that's what's served up to the students. And certainly outside of the colleges, where you get a little bit more in-depth, but you're just basically getting more in-depth brainwashing. You're getting more, so you probably know less, actually. You know, like Thomas Jefferson once famously said in his day, people who don't read the newspapers are better informed than those who do. And, you know, that was back presumably when the news wasn't quite as fake as it is now. So I think the more you are exposed to this type of what I call, you know, mick history or fake history, the less you actually know, and the least likely you are to open your mind to somebody like me. I mean, like, I'm not likely to get any fans that went to Harvard or something like that, because they're going to be so indoctrinated, they're just going to roll their eyes and say, you're crazy. Abraham Lincoln was a hero, or whatever. They're not going to buy any of what I'm selling, even though I'm not posting opinion. I'm posting direct quotes from people. Again, these are and first-hand accounts that are readily available, you know, letters from Union soldiers, things like that. People that were there in the case of World War II. Again, these are readily accessible things. You talk about the controversy of Nuremberg. These are people like John F. Kennedy, Senator John F. Kennedy, devoting a chapter in Profiles in Courage, the book he's most known for, to Robert Taft's opposition to the Nuremberg trials. How many Americans even know that today? So it's not anything. I'm not making up any conspiracy theories, but I think our schools, unfortunately, what history they do teach at the level of high school, especially, is so diluted down and is so twisted by political correctness, so that it ends up being Rosa Parks is more important figure than George Washington in these words or in these worlds, because it's so. Everything is social identity politics, and that has seeped into our schools, especially. You certainly know that. I mean, all the we hear about, you know, banning the use of a boy and girl in elementary schools and stuff. All that is a part of the so-called curriculum now. So the kids aren't learning much of anything. Maybe they're learning how to be good citizens for the state, which maybe that's all public schools maybe always were. But at least in the days when they taught civics and things like that, which they banned civics from before I was in high school. And they used to teach that to people, to teach them how to be good citizens and, you know, follow the rules, which, okay, we may look at it, that's kind of a status thing, but at least they were teaching them decent things and good things. Now they're not teaching them much of anything. They don't learn cursive writing, you know, that kind of thing. They barely, you know, what is a Common Core math and stuff they're teaching now. So they're not about to teach them any real history. And if they do, it's going to be, again, this diluted down, what I describe in the book, where if they touch upon the scope and breadth of American history at all, George Washington was the founder, founding father to remember, and Abraham Lincoln saved the Union. Franklin Roosevelt opened up our society to everyone. And, you know, and then they'll spend a lot of time on the civil rights movement. That's what history is today in the schools, and it's so limited. And that's why I think most Americans today are historically illiterate.
I would agree with that. Well, let's get back into your book, because when we last talked, we talked about all the way up to about World War I, and we covered Lincoln and then after the Civil War and things. Let's start off with World War I. What are some of the big takeaways from World War I?
Well, I think that, you know, unlike the Civil War and World War II, which we are told all the time are good wars, people always talk about, you know, these are good wars. If, you know, Benjamin Franklin said there's no such thing as a good war or a bad peace, and I tend to agree with that. But no one, no court historian, nobody can come up with any even ostensible reason why anyone was involved in World War I, let alone America. We had absolutely no interest, and whereas we had crossed tremendous lines in the Civil War, moral lines in the sand. We crossed a big line in the War of 1898, Spanish-American War, where the first time we got involved outside of the continental United States in a conflict that had nothing to do with us. But in World War I, we really went global. This is when globalists were born, and it was no accident this was born under Woodrow Wilson, who was probably the first globalist in office in the White House, certainly. He was an internationalist. And he was, you know, had a dream of the League of Nations, which became the United Nations later. But as some of his critics said, he wanted to be president of the world. So this was unprecedented. No president up to that point had really wanted to include America in this kind of international thing instead of being a sovereign nation. So that was, although he promised to keep us out of the wars Franklin Roosevelt would do during World War II, he had no intention of that. And he had a few good people in his administration, like William Jennings Bryan, who was the Secretary of State and who was violently opposed to World War I, as were many liberals of the day. Still, they got us in. And because of the precedents Abraham Lincoln had set in the Civil War, people like the socialist Eugene Debs and other World War I protesters were thrown in jail. And got kind of a revival of the Alien Sedition Acts under John Adams, which Thomas Jefferson abhorred, and then we thought we'd gotten rid of that. But unfortunately, and I guess this is where, you know, people don't really know history, and I didn't learn this until I wrote the book, everyone has heard that expression, you have free speech, but you can't yell fire in a crowded theater. Well, that came from a ruling, Supreme Court ruling, the great liberal hero Oliver Wendell Holmes, which upheld Woodrow Wilson's right to throw World War I protesters into prison. And he just invented that term, you can't yell fire in a crowded theater, as if that equated to someone opposing a war, especially a war like this one. So very tremendous precedents were set. And of course, that was from Lincoln's precedent, because Lincoln threw thousands of people into jail that opposed his war. So Wilson used that as a precedent. It was upheld by the Supreme Court.
Hold on a second. So when they threw him in prison, they would say that they would equate it to shouting fire in a theater. And that's what they would claim they did.
Well, the Supreme Court ruled that and used that term because he upheld, because obviously a lot of people, the civil libertarians that existed, the William Jennings Bryans at the time, questioned this. And, you know, hey, you can't do this. And then they took it to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court, again, one of the many disastrous decisions our Supreme Court has made over the years, upheld the right of Woodrow Wilson to throw protesters into jail. And of course, Franklin Roosevelt, by the time World War II came around, there weren't very many protesters left, and they kept that in mind. They knew they would be thrown in prison, and especially the tenor of the country was so different. World War I, there was a lot more skepticism about this. World War II, after the Japan bombed Pearl Harbor and another false flag, the country turned so patriotic that anybody that even dared to, if you weren't planting a victory garden, you know, you were going to go. So almost very few people went to prison because no one dared to oppose it. World War I, there were more people. But not only did you have the carnage of World War I that was so unprecedented and for no reason, again, the court historians can't give you any reason or any principles, any land grabs, nothing. There was no reason for this war at all. It was just massive bloodshed on an unprecedented scale all over the world. Why it was called World War I, the Great World War.
If you talk to Wayne Jett, he's done a lot of research on this as well, you know, like you did. And his research that he came out with is it was simply a depopulation agenda. I mean, they didn't care. It was about getting rid of people. So it makes sense based on what you're saying.
Well, it worked. Yeah. I mean, that was their goal. Sure. Yeah. If that was their goal, it worked. And after World War I, World War II was basically inevitable because of the Treaty of Versailles. Again, whereas after the Civil War, we had this terrible Reconstruction military occupation of the South that led to real bad race relations and eventually the Civil Rights Movement 100 years later, but led to Jim Crow laws and all that was because of the unprecedented action they took in occupying a defeated country. We took this a step further. After World War I, we decided to basically the victors, including America, decided to extort money from Germany, the losers. And that's what the Treaty of Versailles was about. And there's a book called, a long time ago, called Hitler Was Born at Versailles. Hitler was inevitable with the way the after World War I, because they penalized Germany. Most people don't realize, I didn't realize until I wrote this book, Germany didn't stop paying reparations from World War I until 2010.
Oh, my God.
That's how they extort.
I did not realize. Yeah.
Yes.
Wow.
And so basically, and then later when you come to the Nuremberg trials, that was the next logical step. Okay, well, here you've extorted people and you're demanding money from the people you defeated in a war. Whoever thought of doing that? People have been wars forever, but no one ever thought to make the losers pay. That's what they did here. And they kept making Germany pay. And the Great Depression that we would experience in America was nothing, as bad as it was not as severe as what Germany experienced. And again, this is, I believe Hitler had great powers behind him. There's a great book written by Professor Anthony Sutton called Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler, much as he wrote a book called Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution. So I think these forces are behind all these players. I think Hitler was basically a figure that was set up to be the designated loser in this great war. But even if that didn't happen, it was inevitable that a figure would arise like that, because when he was pointing at what was going on, everybody could see the Germans were struggling. Their society was collapsing. They had a worse depression than we had. So they were ripe for someone to come up and still, journalist, and I'm sure he was saying we shouldn't be paying these reparations and all that. And of course, he found the Jews to blame for it all, but people rallied around what he was saying because of the lives they were experiencing. So these things are all connected. So World War II didn't just come out of nowhere. It was inevitable because of World War I. But I think just looking at World War, you had the great General Smedley Butler, who I quote a lot in the book, who wrote War's a Racket, which should have been comparable to Common Sense, the pamphlet that Thomas Paine wrote in the Revolution, because it was that important. I urge everybody to read it. But General Smedley Butler, largely forgotten figure, greatest anti-war activist ever, and good buddy of my hero, Huey Long. You know, these people are all connected. And Huey Long's great-granddaughter, who I communicate with, didn't even know this. But I found out that General Smedley Butler, Huey Long named Butler his fictitious Secretary of War in his posthumously published book, My First Days in the White House. I mean, Huey wrote this great book about what he was going to do. He named his cabinet. He busted FDR down to Assistant Secretary of the Navy, where he originally came from, just to tick him off. And he made General Smedley Butler his Secretary of War. Now, here you have the greatest anti-war activist in the world as your Secretary of War. So you know how many wars, what would happen under a President Huey Long. No war, ever.
But you know what? But I got to tell you, that's what you want. You want somebody who only goes to war for defense. Or right. If you see, you can do an offensive war that makes sense, but it better make sense because you see that it's eventually going to keep you from having to do a big, much bigger defensive war later. But right. In general, and so you do want people like that, generals and people who don't want war. And actually, more of the people now are in the military voting against war because they know. I mean, look at all the suicides.
Sure. I mean, they would be the first people to understand it because they experienced it firsthand. But Butler said afterwards that was the greatest honor of his life to be named Huey Long's Secretary of War in that book. And when they killed Huey Long, which they did, Butler, he said, all my interest in politics died with Huey Long. And he didn't die that long after that either. So these are great men that are largely forgotten, but it was an era. And unfortunately, a lot of people turned their critical faculties off because right after we experienced the first post-war boom after World War I, because we had the Roaring Twenties. Good times, flappers and doing the Charleston and, speakeasies. And, you can see so it looks like a really cool time. Everybody's having all kinds of fun. Great times. But of course, it ended up with the crash because the Federal Reserve had been created. We talked about Lindbergh and Charles Lindbergh's father. Charles was also Charles Lindbergh, wasn't a senior junior. He was a congressman and he was one of the most vocal critics of the Federal Reserve. I have his quotes out there on the record. But it was also inevitable that you would have these constant wars.
Yeah, he said that if people knew what the central bankers are doing, there would be a revolution tomorrow. I mean, he knew what was going on. He was one of the people that got it at the time and was trying to educate. Can you imagine if you knew at the time when they're putting it in place how desperate you would be trying to educate others and they were just all deer in the headlights and you knew the whole country was going down this debt slave system? Well, it would have been awful.
Well, they were great. I mean,
it wasn't just him.
No, it wasn't. Yeah. I mean, Huey Long was one of the first critics of the Fed already. He already recognized it. Henry Ford, Thomas Edison, these people, the captains of industry. There were lots of people. Robert La Follette was another forgotten populist that was a member of Congress. Wright Patman. Lewis McFadden. Lewis McFadden, who was the original critic of the Fed, who I think they killed. I talk about in that book, and they actually attempted to assassinate him prior to that, and he died very mysteriously. But these were vocal critics of the Fed. You had vocal critics of the war. So when the 30s came around and you had the Depression, when they were paving the way to World War II, that's when you had the America First movement, which, Trump got that name from that. And he got I think the main reason he caught so much flack is because people don't learn history. It's equated in people's minds somehow with Nazism, when in fact, the America First movement were mostly led by liberals, classical liberals like John T. Flynn, whose career was ruined by Frank. He was a big time newspaper guy. I have excerpts from the letter that FDR wrote to people in the industry, in the media, that said, don't hire this guy. I mean, it's because that's how much they hated. If he was a classical liberal, most of the people, Sinclair Lewis was a socialist, these were involved with, and of course, Charles Lindbergh, Lucky Lindy, you know, the aviator who would become the Lindbergh kidnapping, which we can fit in here as well. But these were all people that were very much remembered World War One, knew we had fought a war and lost tons of lives in America and all over the world for absolutely no reason at all, and didn't want to see something like this happen again. But the powers that be were pushing it nonstop, and nobody was pushing it harder than Franklin Roosevelt and his entire administration. And again, as I've said many times when studying these events, the so-called liberals, the establishment liberals, forgot liberals like William Jennings Bryan, Smedley Butler, they're not talked about. But the people that we remember, and you know, people like Teddy Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, Franklin Roosevelt, Clarence Darrow, people that are remembered today as so-called liberals, they were all pro-war. They always supported the wars. You know, FDR was a big-time World War One advocate as well. As Assistant Secretary of the Navy, he actually ran afoul of President Harding, who died mysteriously too. We talked a little bit about that. So these people are, these things are happening all the time. It's just most people don't go into them like I do. A lot of these things are completely forgotten, and the connections are forgotten. But I think they're all connected to each other.
Yeah, I'm sure. Now, did you get a chance to figure out what the role of drugs played in these wars, especially World War II? Because I've been doing some studies like crack, and these these drugs were coming online, and they realized that they could keep people awake for days, and they could soldiers weren't as scared, and so they could get them to produce more. Of course, after 3 days of not sleeping, you would crash and you'd have all these problems. But actually, they believe a lot of Hitler's shaking was drugs, not some other sickness. Did you run across that?
No, I talk about, I think it's interesting that that all these drugs were legal, marijuana, cocaine, even heroin, until the 1930s. So it's interesting that there didn't appear to be a problem outside maybe of some few people in Hollywood.
Well, they didn't. The they don't fact, talk. No, yeah, they don't talk about it in history books because they do not want people to know. But it was a huge part of their agenda, especially Germany, to get their soldiers to produce.
Well,
because they were fearless, yeah, and all these other things. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, in Germany, it's hard to, you know, and think when we try to learn about anything, especially with Hitler, because he is the biggest boogeyman compared to nobody. I mean, you know,
yes,
trying to find out the truth about Hitler. I mean, you know, we're still making movies that, you know, Nazi zombies and Hitler's still alive somewhere creating them in a laboratory. I mean, people are willing to believe anything about Hitler, that he had super. So he's of all the boogeymen, he is number one. So trying to find out the truth about him. I mean, was he homosexual? Was he having sex with his niece? Did he have one testicle? Did he was a virgin? I mean, just these things. All these things. Was he a woman? They seriously claimed he was. I mean, these are things that are unknowable because there's so many distortions about what he was. Who can tell? So yeah, I've heard that, you know, was he creating a race of super humans? So was he doing it with drugs? And were they experimenting in labs? Who knows? I don't know. But I mean, it wouldn't surprise me. I mean, Hitler, unfortunately, what happens when you try to ask these questions, then too many people fall into then worship Hitler. Then they, you know, they say he was a great guy or something.
And again, they go to the other extreme.
Yeah, they go to the other extreme. And again, I don't think we can know about any of these people. And that's why when anybody asks me about any foreign leader, I don't know. Because, I mean, I know our leaders. I know what they're doing. And I'm not too happy with them. And I think they're totally corrupt. But I have no idea about the leaders in these other countries. So whether it's the guy in Korea or wherever, I just don't know. Because I think that we don't live in those societies. And I just would prefer to take care of our own problems first. But in the case of Hitler, again, he was inevitable. And once they got to the point where, you know, everyone in Hollywood, from the Three Stooges to Tarzan to Bugs Bunny, and were constantly talking about him. And this was before we got in the war. I mean, people don't realize that Charlie Chaplin broke that third wall in his movie The Great Dictator, which was already an attack on a foreign leader. And this, I think, was made in 30. I think it was made before he even invaded Poland. I mean, because if Hitler, up until when he invaded Poland, if he had died before that, he would probably be remembered as Germany's greatest leader because he had improved the economy. He had not shown those signs of – and then suddenly – and again, I think it was because he was a player that was manipulated and he was orchestrated onto the scene to serve a purpose. suddenly he decided that he wanted to take over the world or whatever. But before that, somebody like a Charlie Chaplin would turn to the screen at the end and basically plead with the audience that we need to stop this madman, we need to stop fascism, and very disturbing. And I talk in the book about how some people were concerned about the propaganda that was coming out of Hollywood, because they were overtly cheerleading for war. And this was before anybody could possibly, certainly before Pearl Harbor, but it was well before even Hitler had taken over Poland or marched into France or the other stuff he did. But
do you see parallels to today, where the Hollywood is so anti-Trump that it becomes scary? I mean, because I just published a report on my website that 90% of the media is anti-Trump. I mean, you just can't be that anti, and he dominates too. He dominates their coverage of the news, and it's anti. I mean, it makes you wonder. I mean, that's just not news. It's very obvious that they have an agenda and a bias, whether you like Trump or not. I mean, it doesn't matter. But when you're doing that, it's very much like what you're talking about before World War II.
Yeah, and I think when you have that kind of monolithic coverage, where it's just it's all the same. There's no you talk about diversity. There's no diversity in the media. I mean, it may be diversity in how they look, but there's no diversity of all in thought. You don't have to. I mean, theoretically, you should not be able to know when you're watching the news who that person is going to vote for. You should have no idea about their political inclination. They should be reporting the news. They haven't done that for a very long time, and they don't even attempt to hide it. I mean, and again, I think it's all – I'm more and more, Sarah, as I'm going into, I think there's so much theater involved in all of this, and Trump is perfect for this because he's very theatrical, and I think that he just is – I think these figures are their rallying cries for people to – divide over their personality, and then it becomes the politics of personality. And so, you know, you're going to vote for if you see something in someone's personality, you know, and it goes back, you know, to, you know, Harry Truman, you know, give him hell, Harry, you know, he can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen. When in fact, Harry Truman was one of the most manipulated presidents ever. He didn't stand up to anyone, you know, his watch.
So you're pretty much telling us. You're pretty much telling us we're really stupid. I mean, honestly, you're going to just, we're paring it down to just somebody's personality. I know, but we're so dumb that all we're going to do is whether we like him, you know? I mean,
I feel it myself. If I look at Trump, my main reason to support him would be because it would tick off the media so much. And enjoy watching that. I mean, that's because...
I look at actions. Yeah, it's a good reason. If you think about it, if they hate him this much and the establishment hates him this much, maybe there is something like he's a reformer trying to do stuff.
He's got all the right enemies.
I don't know.
There's no doubt about that. And but I think, you know, again, we got to this point... Because, and you said, there's no way to present these things without, you know, and producing this evidence without someone like you drawing the conclusion, wow, Americans really are stupid. But I mean, I don't know how else to tell you, because if you just look at let's look at the World War I generation, for instance, there's so many things that they bought at that time. They bought the concept of Uncle Sam. People don't talk about Uncle Sam. Uncle Sam, the figure of Uncle Sam and I want you and pointing the finger and all that contradicted everything that we fought a revolution for. We didn't want this. I mean, it was very close to being a big brother figure, but the World War I generation bought it. They bought it. They bought a Johnny Doughboy. They bought Johnny Get Your Gun. Over there, the songs of George M. Cohan, you know, Born on the 4th of July and everything. That became the new patriotism, a pro-war patriotism. It wasn't, you know, a pro-revolutionary patriotism. It changed very much. And by the time World War II rolled around, we were just completely bought and sold on this. Everything was about you go serve your country. You know, you unquestionably, you go up and you know, as Smedley Butler talked about even more in World War I, there were more people that were unwilling to serve in World War I because they weren't quite as indoctrinated yet. And they were shamed by their communities. They were, you're a sissy, I mean, and worse. you know, you didn't fight for your country, and you know, you were emasculated by World War II. Really, no one had it. One of the things I write about in the book I haven't been asked about is Eddie Slovak, who was a pacifist who was forced into World War II. And, you know, they made a great movie about him in the 70s. It starred Martin Sheen, a young Martin Sheen as Eddie Slovak. Great movie. And they executed this guy for desertion. And they just singled him out. They didn't execute anybody else. And people need to read the story about it. But he didn't want to kill anybody. And that because of that, Americans began to look down their nose at someone like that. I mean, I couldn't do it. I mean, I couldn't go off to war and kill people. And that's, you know, later.
I wouldn't either. Yeah.
Later, they would throw Muhammad Ali into jail because, you know, he didn't want to go to the Vietnam War because he said, you know, no Vietnamese were ever racist to me. And that, so I can understand that. Why?
Well,
would you?
I could come up with a situation where I would fight. Right. If we had to defend ourselves it was really about a right and a wrong.
Yes.
Right. I would be right there.
Sure.
But I'm not going in because these schmucks now, these political a-holes who are so corrupt,
yes,
probably involved with Epstein, making some blackmail deals with some other country,
exactly,
wanting us to go just because they want to get some pipeline for themselves. No way. Unless I knew why. But that's different than fighting a right and wrong war when you are personally at risk and they are really obviously in the wrong.
Yeah, and as you mentioned.
But that's not what we're talking about.
No, and as you mentioned, the population control is a big thing here. If that's what they're aiming to do, killing hundreds of thousands or millions of people at a time is a great way to have, and shaming people who won't go participate in the carnage. And again, this goes back to the Civil War where you were, you know, if you're lucky enough, and certainly after World War II, reading enough about the Kennedys and people like that, and Kennedy with JFK was, you know, the gold medal winner there because he was a genuine war hero on PT 109, and he really did acts of heroism. But if after World War II, your entire political record was based on you entered politics because you were lucky enough to survive the war unscathed, and you were a hero. I mean, so many members of Congress go back just a generation or so were heroic members of World War II, and that's what they were, you know, including Joe McCarthy, Tail Gunner Joe, people like that, that their political careers, and John McCainiac later in a different war would, you know, be basically his entire political career was that he was a POW. There were no other qualifications.
Yeah.
And
there's a lot of good stories behind him. He was at him don't think of him as a war hero because he was
kind
of a traitor. Okay, but
yes. Yeah.
What happened with McCarthy? Yeah, he's a. What happened with McCarthy? You have in your book the death of McCarthy. What happened there?
Well, you know, McCarthy. I how I am, Sarah. I'm not left or right. So in this book, I come out and say I think the Rosenbergs were scapegoats. I don't think they should have been executed, and I think Joe McCarthy was. And you try to figure that out, people's heads explode. What you're defending both the Rosenbergs and Joe McCarthy? But I do. I think they were both victims of what was a phony Cold War.
That's fair.
And in McCarthy's case, I think he was a naive guy and very close friend of the Kennedys. They've tried to scrub from the records now for a long time. It was reported that he was Kathleen Kennedy, Robert F. Kennedy's oldest child, godfather. Now they claim he wasn't, but I don't know what happened. But he was, and he dated some of JFK's sisters, very close friends with old Joe Kennedy. And I believe that he saw this, was presented this issue, thought he could jump on top of it. And he's been, as I put in the book, he's been equated with the House Un-Affairs Activities Committee, Un-American Activities Committee, which was a hideous thing. I mean, Un-American Activities, that I shudder at that concept. But McCarthy had nothing to do with that. McCarthy had a separate committee, and he had nothing to do with the Un-American Activities Committee. So no Hollywood people were blacklisted, came before him. That was all, but in the public's mind, because McCarthy was demonized.
It was, and we call it
McCarthyism. They equate the two. In fact, McCarthy got good press until he started going after the army. And when he started talking about all these figures in the army that were connected to Soviets, that's when they went after him. That's when Eisenhower turned on him. And Truman became vicious against him and so forth. And he had a plant, like they all do. Roy Cohn was this insidious mob-connected figure, a young guy at the time, that was his aide. And I believe he channeled him in certain directions and controlled him in the manner that people have been, it has been done forever, where they'll put like a kind of a gullible Mr. Smith.
He's a mastermind.
Yeah, exactly.
Rook, so he was a mastermind at blackmail and all that. Yeah.
Yeah, he was. So I think so. McCarthy, I don't know how much McCarthy genuinely knew or believed, but he was very naive. But I think what's important is that McCarthy knew, for instance, that James Forrestal, who was the Secretary of Defense and who died, he was first critic of Israel. You know, he was very upset that Israel was formed, as were lots of people at the time. And Forrestal, we had made lots of enemies in Washington. He was Truman's Secretary of Defense. He was the first Secretary of Defense when they changed it from Secretary of War to Secretary of Defense. And he was admitted to Bethesda Naval Hospital and supposedly jumped out of the window. His brother and no one else had any knowledge of it believed that for a second. Very suspicious. Almost everybody believes he was murdered. Joe McCarthy believed he was murdered. He was good friends with Joe McCarthy. In fact, he gave McCarthy one of the great conspiracy quotes that I use all the time in a larger context when he told him, he said, Joe, you know, if this was just by the law of averages things, once in a while they'd make a mistake in our favor. And I think that applies to everything at large. Once in a while they'd make a mistake that would benefit people, you know? They never do. And I think it's a great quote. McCarthy wrote about Forrestal being killed. He said Forrestal was murdered. And this was a United States senator. I mean, imagine today, a United States senator calling out the death of a Secretary of War, a Secretary of Defense, and saying he'd been murdered. I mean, that's, you know, that's more than Trump would do, probably. I mean, that's really, he was very specific about it. So McCarthy enters the same Bethesda Naval Hospital, which, of course, later would be the site of the world's worst autopsy performed on JFK after they assassinated him. So Bethesda has been privy to a lot of these things. McCarthy enters Bethesda Naval Hospital, supposedly with something wrong with his knee, and he dies 2 days later at age 49. They still don't know what he, I mean, I
with
go
what
into
problem?
As much as I can in the book. The people have said he was smeared as an alcoholic afterwards and said he died because of that. Some people have said it was hepatitis. And, of course, no autopsy was done on him. Sarah, what you'll notice about all these things going back to the death of Harding, which was very mysterious and unprecedented. He died on a cruise. He was like 56 or something like that. Died out of the blue while he was on a cruise ship. President of the United States, no autopsy. At the behest of his wife, who was one of the first suspects. Calvin Coolidge, when he died suddenly after he left office, again, 59 years old, no autopsy. Franklin Roosevelt, when he died unexpectedly, fourth term, no autopsy. This is common. In the end, so when McCarthy died under the very weird circumstances, no autopsy, it was par for the course. And again, there were no investigative journalists there to ask why. In fact, I quote some of the things they said. If Trump died like that today, you wouldn't expect any sympathetic obituaries. You would expect still to be that he'd be attacked, and he would be. And that's what happened to McCarthy.
He would be, but people would be questioning.
Well, they would be, but we would, you know.
They might be really vicious, but we would be questioning, and he'd get a flippin' autopsy. That is the difference, but that's the internet.
Yeah,
that's the internet.
The internet would have helped in McCarthy's time, certainly, but he got no autopsy. We still don't know why he died 2 days after going in the hospital for a knee problem at age 49. But again, once they started smearing him, and it was basically a young Jack Anderson and his mentor, Drew Pearson, who were one of the worst of the smear artists, and later they would turn their eyes to the JFK assassination and everything else. They smeared lots of people, and they certainly smeared McCarthy nonstop. They were the ones that first put out there that McCarthy was this huge alcoholic and his tremendous drinking, and nobody knows if that's true or not. But that's – if the public thinks of him now, they think of him not quite at the Hitler level or even the Trump level, but it's – they don't think of him in human terms.
Even the Trump level. Well, let's talk about – I know it's true. It's crazy, the times we live in. You also covered spraying of American people. The fact that we were chemically sprayed and it was pretty widespread. Can you talk about that? Because I don't think people really realize. I mean, we talk about people talk about chemtrails, but this is a different deal. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I think it was an early indication that, you know, people that talk about chemtrails or know what they're talking about. But it goes back, and I included it into, it was basically an outgrowth of this hideous Frankenstein-type experimentation that medical science, often funded by the government and funded by big universities, had been doing on prisoners, mental patients, orphan children, mentally retarded, the most vulnerable people in our society. They had doing hideous experiments, you know, injecting them with diseases. Syphilis was a favorite, to see how they'd react to it. I have a whole timeline of it. And it graduated from there into, let's start spraying diseases onto populated areas. And our military, our intelligence agencies did that. And the whole timeline is in the book. I mean, I quoted extensively. I'm indebted to Michael Rivero, the whatreallyhappened.com website. He had a big timeline on his website, and I borrowed extensively from that and gave him credit in the book. But it's amazing to see what they did. And you know, they're talking about why would you be introducing plagues to areas? And that's what they did. And so when we hear about these things now, there's precedence for that. I mean, it's been done before. So when you hear people, I think I was Hidden History, I started talking about that the terrible flu, I think it was the Spanish flu in the 1918 or something, that wiped out millions of people around the world. For some reason, they decided to keep a strain of that in a laboratory somewhere to study. And they have had people in recent years that want to tamper with that. Does that sound like every horror movie we've ever seen? What good could come out of that? So
it's a movie, yeah.
Yeah, these people, there's a...
There's more and more. The more you're in the more you're in the world that we're in, the more, I mean, when I was just, I was running a company and I was doing my thing and I was kind of clueless as to what was going on, but I thought I knew everything. I didn't know. And then I started getting this, and it's like, the more I learn, the more I feel like it's a Hollywood movie all over the place. The show I just did on John Mark Dugan, it's like Mission Impossible. You know, it's just happening in front of our eyes. But yeah, you're right.
And it's hard.
It's crazy.
That's the hardest part for people that are trying to wake up others, the sleeping masses. The hardest part is that some of this stuff is, most of it is so fantastic and does seem like science fiction that people don't want to accept it. It's J. Edgar Hoover, of all people, said. And again, he was talking about the communist menace, you know, but it could be applied. And certainly Hoover was a conspirator if ever there was one. It's not like he was a good guy, but it can be applied to anything, where he said the average person does not want to confront the extent of what we have here. And you can apply that to any. Does the average person want to believe that we're being sprayed? That's why chemtrails are only popular with a select few, because most people roll their eyes. Oh, yeah, sure. And, you know, everybody's identified the clouds. Alex Jones used to talk about them all the time. Lots of people still do and you know, photograph them and take videos of them online. But it's an outgrowth of what I talk about in this book, where there's a history of this, a precedent. There was a trial over what was sprayed in San Francisco, which killed a man, and the guy's grandson went to trial over it. And, of course, he didn't do well in courts, because our courts are totally corrupt, too, and even more then.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So...
Nobody believes it. It's hard. Yeah. Nobody believes it. And that's why it's so good for you to come out and say, okay, this is really history, people. This isn't make believe. These things happen. It's not that strange. And this is our true history. It's been so watered down in the schools. I think your overview of what we're taught in school just nailed it. I mean, it's like, yeah, that's pretty much what I was taught in school. And that's about it.
Well, yeah,
it's true.
There was more history taught when I was a kid, but I also always loved history, and I really, really loved the period of the Revolutionary War. That excited me as a little kid, and they never spent enough time on it for my taste, but they did spend more time on it back then, so that I learned quotes from Patrick Henry and, you know, Betsy Ross. I mean, does anybody talk about Betsy Ross making the flag? And nobody talks about that. She's been forgotten. They, you know, Paul Revere's Midnight, right? All these things were exciting things that were still talked about then. Gradually over time, when political correctness came to, you know, take over the school systems, really they should still, even though it was long ago, they should spend tons of time, the most time really on that period, because that was our founding. But they can't, Sarah, because if they do, they would have to quote from the documents. They would have to talk about free speech and freedom of religion and the Second Amendment and all that, which they don't believe in. So, you know, they don't want free speech.
They don't believe in what, yeah.
No, so they
don't believe in our Constitution.
No, I mean, how can they quote from George Washington's farewell address when he talked about no entangling alliances with any other nations? of not going. How can they talk? You know, John Quincy Adams, America doesn't go abroad in search of monsters to destroy. That's all we do. It's our entire foreign policy. So they can't. They can't talk about it.
Yeah. Well, we're controlled by others. It's just, it's a craziness. But this book was, the foreword was written by Ron Paul, who is just great. And you, where can you get it? Amazon? Are you selling it directly, or is it just?
No, it's Amazon, Barnes and Noble stores. Anywhere you could. If you Google "Crimes and Cover-ups: American Politics, 1776, 1963," the history they didn't teach in school, foreword by Ron Paul. You can find it everywhere. I mean, it's doing well. I haven't gotten, amazingly enough, considering how controversial it is, considering I'm taking on Abraham Lincoln and FDR and the Nuremberg trials, I've gotten very, very little flack. I mean, I've gotten nothing but positive comments and positive reviews, which is pretty amazing. Not what I expected. I mean, maybe down the road I will, but this is politically incorrect 101.
It's a great book, great Christmas present for sure. Yeah. But you have another book coming out. Tell us a little bit about your next book and when is that coming out?
Bullyocracy. It's how the social hierarchy enables bullying in schools, workplaces, and all over society. Coming out, it's supposed to be January. I'm not sure if it's going to hit that exactly, but it'll be a different publisher. But yeah, looking forward to that. It's a little bit different for me, much as Survival of the Richest is kind of different. It takes me a little bit out of the conspiracy world, but it is a conspiracy because the school systems enable this bullying. And it's I think people will be shocked. It has hundreds and hundreds of anecdotal cases of kids who often ended up killing themselves because of bullying. And it was all attributed 100% to the fact that the schools, from the teacher to the principal, to the school administrator, to the local media, to so-called anti-bullying activists who all actually support bullies that I could find, they all enabled it. They allowed it to happen because they knew who the bullies were in all these cases. They did nothing to stop it, and kids lost their lives. And the ones that survived, I talk about, decades later, they'll wake up screaming or their lives are ruined. They never led normal lives because of what they experienced. And again, it was all because the adult authority figures around them allowed it to happen. So it's just one more criticism really of our decaying and crumbling country, but it's a big thing. And it's hopefully the parents of the children out there who are having to go through this, even as we speak every day, are going through nightmares, simply going to school where they should be learning and having fun, making friends. They shouldn't have to think that the kids as young as 7, 8 years old, which you hear about now, are killing themselves would have been unthinkable even 30 or 40 years ago. I just would never hear of that. It wouldn't even occur to a child, but now it's way too common.
Yeah, it's really sad. Okay. Well, will you stick around to talk to my patrons?
Sure. Absolutely. Sure.
Okay. Thank you so much. I love having you on the show.
Oh, I love being here anytime.